This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Welcome to this very special show today with our guests Robert Sampson from Harvard University and Mario Small of the University of Chicago.
Hello.
Hello.
We're very excited to have you today as we continue a series that we began more than a year ago working on the kind of research background and information from a more scientific point of view about the significance of community efficacy and relationships at a neighborhood level and the value that those kinds of relationships have in terms of helping communities to do better. We have a nation that is struggling on many fronts. Those of you who've been with us for the last 2 years are familiar with the issues that we face both in the workforce, in the classroom, in the home front, of the traditional breakdown of systems that have been in place for years, everything from the farms and the homes, but we don't keep our attention there. We continuously move forward and are looking for ways to ask ourselves, where are we going when you have a world of technology that's been interjected into these systems? And we feel particularly the tension that exists between the world of innovation represented by a fast global technology-driven marketplace and future-driven world of business and the world that needs to be sustainable, that's kind of marked by slow, local, low-impact lifestyles where you have kids and you have families and you have a whole other sense of dynamics going on. The two are distinctly different. And yet they shared this point where they're both trying to adapt and change and move forward. So it is with incredible pleasure that we welcome both of you, Rob and Mario, back with us, Mario for a second visit and Rob for your first visit, to talk with us about what you know and what you found to be true about places where people go and find a new sense of perspective and a new sense of possibility for the future. And Mario, I want you to give us a little bit of a recap of what you told us before about the research you were doing working with childcare centers and parents.
Yes. Thanks, Elaine. One of the things that I've been working on is very much related to what you were just talking about, the fact that today, for many people, it's a lot more difficult than it was, say, a generation ago to sustain meaningful relationships with other people, to develop the kind of support networks that many people, many parents particularly, have been used to having in the past. And this, I mean, I think you alluded to some of the reasons for that, the changes in technology, life is in many ways faster, more people work within the household than it was the case a generation ago. So many parents actually have a harder time than they did in the past forming those kind of meaningful connections that end up being important to civil society. What we ended up finding in our project, we studied parents, most of them were mothers, but there were some fathers, but parents of young children whose children were enrolled in childcare centers. And we studied to what extent they formed meaningful connections to other parents, to what extent the parents formed meaningful connections to other parents, and how much the childcare centers, the way the centers were organized, played a role in that process. And what we found was that in the best case scenarios, in the centers that were most effectively organized, parents actually were quite able to form not just connections, not just somebody they would call an acquaintance, but actually very close connections, very close friendships that created a sense of community that facilitated the parenting process by giving parents someone else to talk to share stories, exchange resources and information with having to do with raising children. And in some cases, creating the kinds of connections that ended up transferring to other areas of their life. So we found that the child care center really ought to be looked at not merely as a place for children, but also as a place for parents and the family as a whole.
Robert, would you comment on that and tell us something in relation to that with the kind of research that you've done?
Sure. Mario Small's work is important because what it's done is to show that organizations in urban communities, even in a world that is splintered by the various social forces that you've noted, provide a certain context whereby parents, children, and others can come together. And what I see is that really the argument is that there are these unintended consequences that come out of that. They weren't planned. Most people think of child care centers as, well, that's where you do child care. That's true, but what they also do is to provide a forum to bring people together. From my perspective, that's important on a number of levels. My research over the years has looked at the nature of neighborhood inequality and the extent to which important dimensions of social life vary among neighborhoods and other types of communities. Even though it's true that we live in a world of high technology and what some claimed is almost a placeless world, the fact remains that many aspects of social life, and it's not just with regard to things like poverty or income and racial composition, everyone knows that they are concentrated in particular neighborhoods, but crime, health, things like low birth weight, teenage pregnancy, all manner of social life is highly variable by communities. What we've tried to do in our research is to tease out the various dimensions of that, what causes it, and what are the consequences. One of the important things that has come out of the research, we feel, is to show that the social quality of a neighborhood is important in predicting a number of outcomes, whether it be crime rates, the health of children in the community. Even in some of our recent research, we've shown that verbal ability, or what some would call the capacity of children to learn, is affected by the neighborhood. So it's important to begin to think about the characteristics that are rooted in neighborhoods that might be manipulable and might be subject to interventions on the part of society. And one of them, going back to Mario's work, I think has to do with organizations. That's a locus of importance in the community, and the extent to which organizations are connected to one another and the kinds of services they provide to families can provide other kinds of opportunities and outcomes for parents.
In what way have organizations superseded family or the things that families used to do for people?
Well, I wouldn't say they've superseded them as much as it's a more organizational world. Families are reliant on a number of organizations to get done the sorts of things that they've always had to do. I mean, if you take schooling and the concern with what's happening after school, more parents are working, so-called latchkey children. I mean, that's always been an issue out there. I think what we're seeing is the extent to which in certain communities, and this is part of a debate in the field of sociology, actually, is to what extent in low-income neighborhoods in particular, where you have a number of children that are high risk for high school dropout, for crime, and so forth, whether there is the sort of organizational infrastructure that is needed. I think that, in fact, in many neighborhoods, there is a fair infrastructure that's there to be built upon. Some of the work has shown that it's not necessarily the case and that all poor neighborhoods are bereft of community. That's sort of the myth. And in fact, there's many poor communities that have, for example, dense concentration of churches and so forth. The question is, to what extent are they serving the needs of the community And it's not necessarily the case that just because you have a lot of organizations in a community that they are, in essence, of the community. That is, they may be located there. The question is, to what extent are they connected to the residents?
You know, another way to think about this issue in light of your question, Elaine, is to think about parenting and children and childcare centers. So part of the way of understanding your question, and this is the issue of whether organizations are not doing what families used to do, is to think about one generation ago. A generation ago, less than a quarter of all mothers of 3- and 4-year-olds work for pay outside of the home. So most of the mothers of very young children stayed at home. Now, some of them ended up working when the children were older. Some of them stayed at home, period. But certainly, the numbers were pretty low back then. If you look now, that figure is more than 50%. And so the question, and this is a question I'm hoping we get to after the break, is whether that has changed the abilities of parents to take care of their children as effectively as they used to. And I think the answer is maybe, but it doesn't have to.
Very well done. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Mario. It took us out, leading us in this area of the impact that organizations have and the good they can achieve and help families do better with their kids or not. And I want you to finish that comment for me, Mario, because what I'd like to have happen is I'd like to then have Robert turn around and give us some feedback on the idea of how policy then impacts the organizations that are attempting to serve what we think is a local issue.
So, yeah, I'd be delighted to. So the issue was whether in the past families used to do certain things that now organizations are really doing instead. And the example I was using is looking at raising children. And if you look at the data, you'll see that a generation ago, many more mothers of young children stayed home. Less than 25% actually worked for pay outside of the home at that time. Today, the figure is more than 50% working for pay outside the home. And so people are turning much more to child care centers to do some of the work that they did before. Now, the question is whether this means that basically families and parents are abandoning their responsibilities, in a sense, or turning off to child care centers what they used to do themselves. And I think that the answer is not necessarily. There were good parents then, and there are good parents now. There are certainly involved parents then, but there were also uninvolved parents then who stayed home but really weren't doing very much child rearing. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. I think what happens now is you have a situation where the organization, the child care center, can be either a facilitator or not of parenting. The organization can work with the parent by building networks among parents, by providing access to information that helps parents in the child rearing process, that encourages either through requirements of the center or, for example, to participate in some of the field trips or other activities that the centers engage in, that encourages the center, the parent, to get involved in the activities of the child, or it cannot do that. So I think what we ought to do when we think about this question today is not to think whether now parents have an easy way out, but how we can use organizations, how we can use the fact that more parents are involved one way or another with these organizations to help them in the child rearing process, to make the child rearing process a more collective process as opposed to a process in which the responsibilities are handed off to someone else. And I'm using child care centers as an example, but the same can be said for child care centers, for schools, for civic associations, for churches, depending on how they're organized. I think all of these organizations can be structured in such a way that they encourage the kind of civic participation that I think most of us would agree is important to a contemporary society.
Well, I want you to finish that example, and then I'd like to have Robert comment on the kind of policy development, the difference between a policy and kind of a local neighborhood thrust, like, for example, as he found in his work.
Exactly. So a quick example is many of the parents in the poor, many of the low-income neighborhoods, the centers in the low-income neighborhoods that we studied, had parents who really had no idea how to deal with the school system. And we're talking about the elementary school system in New York, where most of this research was done. And these were parents who either were intimidated or simply unaware of their rights and responsibilities with respect to the school. Now, in some childcare centers, the director made it a point to find ways of getting parents involved effectively civically. For example, centers had a parents' association with a president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer, all parents, who had to be elected by other parents. So it provided an opportunity for parents to sort of practice self-governance in some capacity. And these were organizations that organized many of the activities of the centers, including field trips, fundraising activities, graduation events, and so on, but also did versions of this organizing in conjunction with the state bureaucracy. So they brought representatives from either actually both private and public schools to talk to the parents about the schooling process. These are all ways in which basically parents gained the skills so that by the time the children were ready for elementary school, they knew how to navigate the system a lot more effectively. They were much more comfortable with navigating the system effectively. They felt a greater sense of self-efficacy with respect to raising their own children. That's just a small example of how I think you can structure an organization in such a way that it encourages civic participation.
Robert, you comment on that from the neighborhood point of view?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things going on here. One is that we seem to be in agreement that there is a phenomenon of civic capacity that exists out there that's highly variable by neighbors. And the world has changed. It's not the case that we know each other on a close-knit basis as we allegedly have in the past. By the way, I'm not so sure that was the case, actually, if you go back and look at research in earlier decades. There's some evidence that people knew each other a bit more, but really, even back in some of the classic studies of Chicago, there was a clip in one of them that even in the, you know, the Gold Coast, people don't know their neighbors. So we really have to think about the social relationships and the kinds of cultural and civic capacities that are generated beyond that interpersonal tie. And that's one of the things that we've looked at in our Chicago research in the form of what we've called collective efficacy. The idea really is that there are important differences in the sense that people either think about their neighbors as being part of a sort of the same community, that they have shared expectations, for example, how children will be raised, how children will act in public. We find that there's huge variations in the extent to which people expect kids to, for example, go to school, if they're skipping school, whether parents will do something about it. That is part of a certain efficacy on the part of residents. It's not just about an individual, it's about the collective capacity of the community. That sort of collective capacity doesn't just come out of the blue. It tends to be generated in certain kinds of contexts where people have a trusting relationship. What's important about collective efficacy and what's important about the kinds of relationships that Mario is talking about, again, is that they're not necessarily tied to an individual. They can be generated by, for example, organizations, in the case that Mario was talking about, child care centers. But they also come out of naturally occurring conditions. That's where I would argue that policies, both now and in the past, are implicated in the extent to which civic capacities, the collective efficacy of community, is produced. And give you some examples. We can think of federal policies. We can think of state, city policies with regard to housing, with regard to home ownership. For example, in many cities, deliberate decisions to concentrate poverty in particular kinds of housing projects have led to dense concentrations of poverty, racial isolation. These are not accidents. These are not natural. These were federal policies that are manifested in local communities. Current policies with regard to foreclosure, in certain neighborhoods you have high rates of bank foreclosures, now vacant homes. the extent to which communities are disorderly in the sense of people perceive them to be either sort of generating a decline, there's a disinvestment in the area. This generates a self-reinforcing negative cycle. We've shown that in our work. We've shown that people's perceptions of disorder is a very important factor in predicting whether or not that neighborhood is on a trajectory downwards or upwards. We can think about policies in terms of home ownership, various policies with regard to dispersal of public housing residents. We can think about policies with regard to immigration. And we can go on and on. The point is that there is really a false distinction, I think, out there between thinking about the conditions in a local neighborhood or a local community or even at the city level and larger policies. They, in an ideal world, should be thought about in the same way, and that is how they work together or how they are working against each other. Unfortunately, usually we don't have conversations across these different levels, and then what happens is that we have lots of unintended consequences that go in the negative direction.
So, Robert, what I'd like to do, maybe we come back from the break, is talk about how do we take this research and apply it in a practical sense relative to the real communities that we're part of? Because I think the community stakeholder leaders we talk to, you know, whether it's business, you know, whether it's government, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's media, whether it's particularly all the community-based organizations and parents themselves would really value some sense of your perspective. What do we do with this research going forward in the real communities that we live in today? This is Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott with Mario Small and Robert Sampson. We'll look forward to talking to you right after the break.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips-Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
Well, welcome back to Birth to Work Radio. This is Rick Steams with Elaine Scott and Robert Sampson and Mario Small, and we're having a delightful discussion about community capacity and capability and civic capacity, which is so critically important to not only economic development, but down to where we're trying to go about how do we help develop people to be successful in their local and broader economy. And before the break, we got into a real interesting discussion about policy and the implications about policy, what goes on at a local level, and the research that both Robert and Mara have been doing. Gentlemen, can you help give our audience, the stakeholder leaders who are in the community, some sense about how can they take your research and apply it in a practical sense to improve really what goes on in communities? Because all our experience says people really want to create communities where we want to live, work, learn, and play. And there are so many people, there's so many resources being applied. Yet when we look at high school dropout rates, we look at teenage pregnancy, Boy, let me tell you, there's some real struggles that we see across this nation and in specific communities. So give us some insights about how to take what you're talking about that some of us can say, what do we do going forward with this?
I think that's a great question. I can take a first stab at it. If I were to say sort of what ought we be doing in a nutshell, I would say encourage collective responsibility. If I were running a school, childcare center, church, local organization of any kind, and I was trying to find a way to get people to form those connections that I think both Rob and my research have shown are important, those collective connections among neighbors, and encourage people to develop civic participation ideals, I think the idea would be to encourage collective responsibility. And what I mean by that is something simple. Often when I've talked about the value of networks, people respond with something like, well, all you have to do is get the parents to talk to each other more socially. And the truth is that what you're going to get there is basically a whole bunch of people telling you, I'm too busy, right? We're all busy. But suppose that instead of doing that, you structure your organization around formal collective responsibility, meaning, for example, that in order for you to have your child in a center, you have to volunteer for a certain number of field trips over the course of the year. Or you have to participate in some capacity in at least one of the parent association elections. Or you have to fundraise over the course of the year, for example, $300 or $400, as was the case in some of our centers, such that in order to fundraise, you have to get together with other people and figure out how you guys are going to collectively come up with the equivalent of $400 each. These are all requirements. These are all practices that encourage collective responsibility. And I would say that the research is not unambiguous, but it pretty strongly suggests that these tasks of collective responsibility end up forming at least some of those connections, some of that collective efficacy that the research of Rob and many others has shown to be so important.
I think that's right. I would add a few other things. I would start at a very basic level, first with information. I don't think that we have the kind of practical information that organizations and people in communities could actually use. One of the things that we find is that oftentimes people aren't actually aware of either the existence of organizations in their community or about various social issues, various social problems. One of the things that we've tried to do in our Chicago project is to develop a systematic metric, what we've called ecometrics, a metric for ecology, whereby one can systematically develop a means to assess things that go beyond just the materialistic aspects of life, things like social control, the social support systems that exist in a community, the social networks, the organizations. I mean, why is it that we have all kinds of economic indicators that are reinforced by government year after year? We have the GDP. We don't have the kinds of social indicators that we really should. If we had that kind of information, people could draw on it. They would be aware whether their community was high, low, declining, increasing, and so forth. They could monitor, and then they could better react. One cannot intervene in a community if one doesn't really know what's going on in terms of the basic social infrastructure. What Mario and I are about as sociologists is really trying to understand the nature of the social structures and the social interactions in communities. That is the heart of a social view of the world. It's not just about the individuals. It's not just about their poverty. It's not just about their race. It's about the nature of their social interactions. If that's true, and we believe it is, and we believe the data show that that's the case, one needs to be able to collect that kind of very practical information. In fact, there are various moves around this country that are now doing this, have picked up on measures. Collective efficacy measures are used in many places now, the Sustainable Seattle Project. I could go on and on. So that's one point. Second, I think that safety, crime is a what I would call a first-order problem. We have to establish a base level of safety in communities. Kids can't learn. People don't walk on the street. People are fearful. We have to reestablish in some of our most high-risk communities that kind of environment. Now, there's lots of debates about how best to do that. I'm not claiming a magic bullet, but there's a fair amount of research now that suggests that certain forms of community policing, such as has been done in Chicago and other communities, combined with information dissemination in the form of hotspots, problem hotspots, and so-called problem-oriented policing. The idea here is that the police work with the community. The residents of a community identify problems, perhaps ones that the police don't know about. And research has shown for a long time now that people are often very concerned about things that we might offhand think of as trivial, like the vacant house on the corner that's being used to deal drugs or for prostitution. Those are the kinds of things that have other kinds of effects. And community policing, particularly beat meetings and other forums, provide an opportunity for residents to get together. In fact, one might think of the beat meeting as an organizational form that's not all that dissimilar from Mario's child care centers. You go, the idea, at least people think, is to deal with a particular problem, but then they meet others, they find out about other issues, they find out about other sources of support, which then have unintended consequences. So I would support more along those lines. I totally agree that we need to increase collective responsibility. In fact, I would argue even perhaps that we need to change the culture. In our society, we're much too focused on individualistic theories of behavior, but also individualistic reward systems. We need, I think, to promote culturally a sense in which caring for others, social support, intervention, altruism, and so forth are rewarded. And this happens in other places and other times, and there's variations across countries even. So there's good evidence to suggest that there are institutional and cultural means to provide cultural reward systems that would be more linked to this idea of a collective responsibility, which naturally leads to more of the civic and collective capacity that we're talking about. Finally, I would, again, point to various federal policies and local policies that have to do with very concrete aspects of the structures of community with regard to the concentration of disadvantage, with regard to residential stability, and, again, with regard to the organizations and the organizational structures of the sorts that Mary was talking about.
You know, Rob's point about the violence actually brings up an important issue in answer to your question, Rick, about what people can do. I think one of the most important things to do is to get people to think about problems as being interconnected. So we typically think, for example, about violence and crime as a problem for the police,
mm-hmm.
and about education as a problem for the school district. And yet, in a recent study, we found actually that these two things were strongly related in a way that we didn't anticipate. So we were looking at how mobility affects how children form friends, how the fact that in so many schools, children are moving in and out of the school, of the classroom, over the course of the school year, and therefore making it difficult for teachers to teach. So we went into this and to see how this affected peer network formation, how children form friends. And we found that it didn't make such a big difference because so many of the students were so worried and scared about the violence taking place in the neighborhoods, this was in Chicago poor neighborhoods, that the problem of the educational problem became superseded by the violence problem. So there was no way that you were going to simply solve the educational problem by ignoring the problem, the wider violence problem. I would say that in terms of encouraging civic responsibility, an important aspect of this is helping people realize that many of the problems that we have are interconnected.
Could I jump in on that? I would totally agree. In fact, some of our research in Chicago that's looked at the community leaders has shown a similar phenomenon. We tend to break down the world almost in an organizational chart format. Schools do education, churches do religion. They do, but they do many other things. Churches are involved with kids that are in trouble with the law. Schools are dealing with kids from troubled families. Law enforcement officers often counsel kids. It cuts across all kinds of boundaries. So therefore, we need to set up systems whereby the organizations themselves are better able to share information about particular families, about particular kids, and what the successes and failures are.
Well, what a terrific answer to the tough question. We'll look forward to further this discussion. We come right back from the break. Well, welcome back. This is Rick Steams and Elaine Scott with Birth to Work Radio and Robert Sampson and Mario Small, and continuing this discussion about what really goes on as social systems and increasing collective responsibility and the importance it has to overall community success. Well, one of the important elements that clearly, as we talk about communities and systems, must be the impact that that concept of thought has about education and learning. Rob, can you maybe give us your perspective about how this begins to tie together in that particular important area?
Sure. Well, in today's world, of course, education is increasingly important. Our research shows that learning, and particularly the learning of verbal and math skills, is not just something that occurs within the school, and it's not just about teachers. We showed in our Chicago research that kids that lived in severely concentrated, disadvantaged neighborhoods, these are neighborhoods that are poor, high rates of unemployment, high rates of female-headed families, that have a constellation of factors, in other words, that lead to their social disadvantage. Kids that grow up in those neighborhoods, we showed that their verbal ability was affected. In fact, the pretty much equivalent to losing almost a year of schooling was linked to living in a disadvantaged neighborhood. Moreover, and this is the scary part, that it has a lingering effect. That is to say, even if a child or his or her family moves out of a disadvantaged neighborhood, if they grew up in that neighborhood and lived in it during critical periods, that effect of, in essence, losing the equivalent of a year's worth of schooling sticks in there. And that is very problematic, and it suggests that there is a durable effect of neighborhood on children's learning. And this is not surprising because especially verbal ability and language is a social phenomenon. It occurs in social settings. So I would say that it's critically important that we take seriously all elements of children's development. I talked earlier about crime and safety. That's all crucially important. But this evidence suggests that learning and cultural aspects to growing up, because after all, language is part of culture, is affected by neighborhood. And I would add that now there's research coming out of experimental and quasi-experimental studies that is showing a similar thing. Furthermore, I think it's important to make the link to schools as a form of community. They may or may not be in the residential community that a child lives in. It varies a lot by city. But a lot of research lately is showing that schools vary tremendously in their collective efficacy as well. That is, the concept of a collective capacity can be applied to organizations, not just neighborhoods, the school being an important one. Quick example, some of the research of researchers actually at the University of Chicago, in Chicago, has shown that the amount of trust among teachers and a shared sense of agreement, shared expectations about the curriculum, cohesion among teachers with regard to their attitudes and links among one another was linked to better outcomes for students. So it's not just about the student and his or her ability. It's also about the social context, the social quality, or what I would, again, call the collective efficacy of the school. And this holds regardless of whether or not a child is poor, middle class, white, or black. So there are some general principles here, I think, that we can apply to organizations, the school being an essential one. I imagine, too, that the sense in which organizations trust one another, can work together or not, is important with regard to the efficacy of communities. Some of the areas in Chicago that we've looked at, and actually some other cities as well, suggest that when you have organizations that are cynical, they are paranoid about one another, they're simply seeking to extract resources from City Hall and not work with other organizations, that in a sense defines a community that doesn't have a collective orientation. So we can think of these in rather broad ways.
Can this be measured by your meter that you were talking about earlier? Is this one of the measures of that, the echometrics?
I would say it can. In fact, there's pretty straightforward ways to measure it at the neighborhood level, at the school level. Haven't done it yet at the organizational level, but I would maintain that you can.
You know, some really powerful thoughts there that you've been talking to, this notion about this is more about, again, the collective responsibility and civic capacity than it is about money. Not that money's not important in terms
yes,
of
some capabilities. Yes, I want to be clear, though. I'm not saying this is not a Pollyannish, so pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Of course, resources are important, but we tend to, just like the federal-local issue, there tends to be a debate in the field, and there's this sort of materialist camp that would say, well, it's all about money, and others would say, no, it's all about social capital. I think Mario would agree with me that what we need is a conversation that brings these two together because they're interdependent. The resources are in part linked to why it is that certain communities are showing high levels of cynicism and low efficacy. I mean, after all, many communities have been mired in poverty, high crime, out-migration, and neglect by City Hall for decades. Even though different people are passing in and out of those communities, they are showing durable legacies of inequality. That's part of a resource base, and that's in part responsible for the collective efficacy and trust in the community. Our data in Chicago show that we can predict a community's level of collective efficacy from its concentrated poverty rate of 15 years prior. That's a pretty powerful finding.
I think a way of thinking about this particular debate is that the people who complain that government can't do everything are right in the sense that responsibility is important, but are missing the fact that smartly instituted policies can actually encourage people to take responsibility. And I think maybe that's a different way of thinking about this issue. I think the case of schooling, it's actually important. It's actually not only an important one, but actually a prime example of this in several of the ways we've talked about today. So we've talked about the fact that some sense of collective responsibility is important, but we've also talked about the fact that many of the problems that we've talked about are interrelated. And you can see this very easily in the school. The learning aspect, the educational aspect of schooling is affected by the health and nutrition aspect. If children don't eat good breakfast, they're not going to learn well. If there are other health issues related to their neighborhood or to their family conditions, they're not going to do well. But that's also related to the violence in the community, right? If the community is very violent and the children are scared about walking home alone, which happens in Chicago very often, good luck trying to get them to concentrate. So all of these issues are interrelated. And, of course, the parents' side of this is related as well. Children learn better if their parents are involved in their learning. And so if you can encourage parents to participate, you're also going to improve schooling. So these diverse problems are all interrelated, and I think the school can be seen as a way of addressing them. In that context, we can think about the relationship between policy and civic responsibility as being very easily evidenced in the school. A small government policy that encourages parents to get involved can actually be a way of addressing many different kinds of problems at once.
I am practically breathless as I listen to all of this information coming and flowing back and forth between the two of you. The issues, a couple of things that you talked about, Robert, about the, as I said earlier, the BEAT, meeting in an organizational mm-hmm. forum, and looking at what kind of, you know, collective action can people take around a particular issue and then eventually develop a process. The process that we talk about in our book, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is precisely and exactly what you're talking about. We came upon it from another angle that had to do with building large-scale sustainable programs that require that people work together and out of a sense of conscious commitment to a project and having developed common language and a sense of common and shared views about the value of what it is they're doing. And I'm wanting now to really focus in another session on the whole idea of policy that exists outside the community, driven outside the community, and the sense of joy and excitement that people get from developing this collective efficacy. I don't think that just happens. And I think, Mario, you touched on it when you talked about the daycare center and parents having to be responsible and coming around to that. I just think there's some room here for even more discussion around this area. And I'm very hopeful that you'll, you know, in the future, accept an invitation to talk with us about that again.
Well, it's particularly important because of language. It's not about intent. It's the language that tends to divide us. And what we want is the language to bring us together.
Absolutely.
And forms to talk about in terms of community and school can be those forms to bring that language
That's
together.
That's exactly right. And that is the place where it can actually happen. And so when you talk about coming back together around this sense of collective responsibility for those actions, we're there. Our deepest, most sincere gratitude to Harvard University's Robert Sampson, sociologist, and definitive researcher, and his friend and colleague Mario Small from the University of Chicago with work on children and child care centers and the benefits they are to parents. Please look for their information on our website and look to us again for more information. This is Elaine Scott
and Rick Stevens,
and this is Birth to Work Radio. We'll talk with you again next week.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.